This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May. I am sitting here physically with Dan Carey, but we also have a guest today joining us via Zoom, which is, I believe, the second time we've done this with one of your just amazingly qualified friends. So who do we have with us, Dan?
Well, we have Greg Casey, known for a long time. I've known him first by reputation, by his writings, and I guess, you know, maybe communicating by emails. We communicate about lager yeast. Greg has a lot of experience in lager brewing and also with lager yeast. So I guess we kind of share an interest in beer geekdom, particularly around lager yeast, which is a very interesting story in itself.
Yeah, when you sent me an email, you know, with a list of people you might want to talk to, and Greg's name was on there, I think it was just like one line where it said, you know, a scientist, and then a list of the breweries he's worked for. And then, you know, so I'm looking him up today because I like to keep it kind of fresh. And it's, Greg, you were born in Toronto, Canada, and you got your bachelor's of science degree in applied microbiology, then went on to get your PhD in 1984 in applied microbiology and food science, then went and worked at NATO as a postdoctoral scientist in Copenhagen before returning as an assistant professor in Saskatchewan, a position which you held for about a year before going to work for some of America's largest lager breweries. Does that sound about right, Greg?
Yeah, that sounds about right, with the exception of, I remember when I first day going to that brewer in St. Louis, and I left Canada with a 1 and 3-year-old children and a wife, like, how in the heck am I going to, you know, make this transition from academia to industry and possibly add any value to a company as big as Anheuser-Busch? So, yeah, that was the journey that got me there. But there was a meeting beforehand that was crucial in that development.
Well, and just reading that, I can see why you and Dan sort of have hit it off. You guys both seem to have like really gravitated towards, you know, why beer behaves the way it does. You know, in particular, lager beer and lager yeast behave in the way it does. We've sort of heard where Dan sort of got his interest in lager beer, but for you, Greg, when do you sort of recall the first times you were really lager beer piqued your scientific and creative interest?
Well, I guess, you know, I got to go back when I was a young buck and just getting out of high school in Toronto. Like everybody in the 70s, I want to be a marine biologist, right? I want
to be Jacques Cousteau.
Oh, yeah, the Canadian version of him.
The French-Canadian version.
Yeah. But I went, you know, first I went to University of Guelph because there's only two colleges in Canada at the time that you can get a bachelor's in marine biology. But then I took a course in fermentation science. And a gentleman I'm sure Dan knows quite well, Professor Graham Stewart.
Oh, yeah.
Labatt's. He came to Guelph. It's only about an hour's drive. And gave us a lecture on fermentation science and opportunities in the industry. And it piqued my interest. And I decided there's probably more opportunities in brewing than there is in an aspiring marine biology. So I went into fermentation science and brewing. And eventually that morphed into, by the end of 4 years, getting an offer from Labatt's to become a management trainee program in their system. So I was going to join Labatt's in 79, but then they had a strike. And my young wife of...
Which Canadians are apt to do from time to time.
Oh, yeah. They always got a Scottish accent, these strikers. The mail and the transportation and TTC. We're on strike. I mean, growing up, man, it seemed every union leader had a Scottish accent. It was fun.
You can't invite the Scots anywhere. They just start causing trouble.
Oh, yeah. You don't mess with them, too. You know.
Yeah, that's true.
The hard way a couple times, too. But, yeah, so that strike, but for that strike, I was going to go to Saskatoon, where she was. She'd only been a dietitian for a few months, and I was going to join her there. And then after a year as a trainee.
This is your wife?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Lynn Casey of 45 years. Got
congratulations.
Years, but that's another story altogether. But yeah, they went on strikes, so they wanted me to go to Newfoundland and St. John's. And I went, I can't do that to my new wife. She just had a job. The understanding was we'd each overlap for a year in Saskatoon and then move on. But the strike ended that. And in the interim, I'd already gained a scholarship from the Canadian government to do a PhD. And I chose to do that at the University of Saskatchewan with a guy named Mike Engledew. So, but for that strike, I would not be sitting here today, I guess, because I probably would have stayed within the Labatt system. And that's what got me into lager, because Mike was all about high gravity brewing. It was all lager fermentation. This was late 70s, early 80s. High alcohol was synonymous with gasohol, you know, with the oil crisis. And so I had a good 5 years there. I also taught a bit with my supervisor, went on sabbatical to, you know, through Molson's, and got to see their Prince Albert Brewery, got to get the materials, became familiar with the you know, the basics of lager brewing through that.
That's awesome. And what strikes me in this story is the similarities that sort of happened, are cropping up between you guys, because, you know, you weren't originally going to go to brewer. You were going to be a firefighter.
I was going
to
be a firefighter, and I was number five or something on the list in San Francisco to get a job. And they somebody sued the city and said there's a problem with the way they were testing, and they ended up throwing it out. And I said, well, I guess I'll go to brewing school.
So it's just funny to me, like the winds of the like political change, or yeah, like exactly. Something happens and all of a sudden it's like, the world has one less marine biologist, the world has one less firefighter. Yeah. But they have these two sort of preeminent voices in lager brewing now. So, you know, if someone didn't sue the city of San Francisco, and if, you know, if they were paying the truck drivers properly or whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
We would have two very different outcomes in the world of beer, I think.
Yeah. It's true.
So Dan, when do you first remember meeting Greg or becoming acquainted with him? And how did, and what kind of, you know, is he like a sounding board or a collaborator, or how do you guys communicate?
I guess you could say that I first met Greg through his writings, in the Master Brewers and Association Brewing Chemists. Mm-hmm. He has fish diagrams about all these
fishbone diagrams.
Yeah, fishbone diagrams about all of the various aspects about problems that happen in beer and how to solve problems. And so, you know, all of us in the brewery over the years have pored over those documents looking for that, you know, there's all of these things that can cause a problem. And, you know, there's like 100 of them that are the 20%, and then there's one or two that are the 80%, and you just have to find that. So that was, and also, his writings in technical journals. And one thing about brewers is in the Master Brewers Association, it's really easy to contact somebody by their email address, because the members' email address are all there. So, you know, I'm sure that I worked for Anheuser-Busch in Colorado. Mm-hmm. And I think, Greg, you were probably at Coors at that time early 90s.
No, I was actually Anheuser-Busch 1987-91, Stroh from 92 to 99.
Ah, okay.
Coors. Molson Coors, Miller Coors.
Okay.
From 1999 to 2013.
Okay. So where we really started to communicate was I contacted Greg because he had written about his research looking at different families of lager yeast, basically splitting the families of lager yeast into two groups. And one of them is, I don't know, Greg can speak to it. They're different. One is more suited to the American palate.
Gotcha.
And this is a categorization he came up with. So I contacted him to try to understand his research and how we could use that to improve our beer, number one. And then it led into a discussion, a triangular discussion we had with Matthias Hutzler, who's a professor in Munich, mm-hmm. talking about, because Matthias was doing a lot of work on where lager yeast came from, because it's a relatively, you know, it's only been around for 400 or 500 years.
Yeah.
And it was basically a human intervention that created this lager yeast. And so I knew Greg's experience and knowledge. And so we triangled and we started to basically be pen pals talking about, talking about research, because research is really starting to heat up because understanding of genetics is increasing. And
yeah,
Greg had done a lot of work in the old days about genetics. So he was very interested and helpful in that discussion. And I think he and Matthias also hit it off.
That's really cool. And for Greg, do you, you know, I know for people who want to share information, want to write, and especially, you know, people who get their PhD want to publish in those fields, right? How is it then when you publish something and then you have a brewer from, you know, Wisconsin or from wherever, emailing you and asking you for your opinion on their process or their beer or what they have going on, just as like an experience of someone trying to share knowledge, how does that, you know, feel when you get those sort of contacts?
Well, you know, it's a good question, Scott. I mean, there is a price you pay to a certain degree when you leave an academic environment going into industry. So, mm-hmm. You know, I would say probably about 80-90% of what I focused on, because I'm an applied brewing scientist. So I had to add value to Anheuser-Busch and all these other places.
Yeah.
Was proprietary. And it did, to Dan's point, I mean, it was all focused on the American light lager. And I like to refer to it as a yeast delivery vehicle, because you're sure as heck you're not getting hops, you're not getting malt. The style has evolved, particularly the American light lager, to be the most drinkable, refreshing style of beer in the world, despite all the baggage it has with jokes and critics and all that good stuff.
I always found that funny, because like for something supposedly that everyone doesn't like, they sure sell a lot of it.
That's right.
It's like Neil
Diamond music. Yeah. Everybody hates Neil Diamond, but if a Neil Diamond song comes on, everybody knows the words to it. So. Yeah,
exactly. It's like, no one reads that guy yet. He's on the bestseller list. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know, just a little aside, guys, the editor, John Palmer, I'm sure you guys, you know, very familiar with John. The only line he wouldn't let me use in the series was, I'm a Swiftie. I like Taylor. I admire her.
Yeah.
She's, you know, what she's done as an artist is incredible to me. And you know, she's a role model. But I want to use players going to play, and the haters are going to hate in terms of, you know, the critics of the style, you know, because Taylor was born in Reading, Pennsylvania, which is where Frederick Lauer was supposedly 1842, the first lager brewed. So they have that in common, but he wouldn't let me go there because I was basically telling critics today, modern critics, well, you're about a century and a half late criticizing the style, because it was equally criticized as being not pure, not real beer, even in the 1800s and before Prohibition. Anyhow, that was a little aside.
No, and that sort of stuff is just very, very interesting to me in the, you know, in the tale of the American light lager, right? Because, you know, we've talked about American light lager on this podcast quite a bit, and we talked about it for like almost an entire episode, and it's, and you're right, and I'm sorry if I derailed your point, that it did evolve to become easy drinking by design. It was a unique creation of on this continent, but then, you know, as the sort of wheels of capitalism do, they refined it until they got to exactly where they wanted to be with it, to sell as much of it as possible, right? It's as palatable as it possibly can be. As, you know, both brewing scientists, how hard is it to actually accomplish something like that over the seemingly short amount of time they had to evolve that beer?
Greg, why don't you feel that one, since you're writing a book on that subject?
Yeah, and we got to mention the fact that you were writing like a series of books on lager beer.
All right. Yeah, thank you. Well, first of all, to me professionally, I don't have the experience, Dan. I'm not a brewer. I'm a brewing scientist, right? I mean, I love to tell my son that, because I've had very little hands-on experience designing brews and
Well, he's a great
conducting.
brewer in his own right.
He is, yeah. He is a real brewer. So at least the family has one Casey that knows what the hell they're doing in a brew house and sitting down and coming up with formulations. But in a nutshell, the style, as it's progressively gotten lighter, adjunct lager beer really started in the United States about 1870s. It was based on, and these, this is, I talk about this in the third volume. It was a style that German brewers brought to America, the use of rice, the use of other adjuncts outside of Bavaria, of course, but in much of Germany to brew using rice. They call it rice beer. And it was actually more expensive in Germany as it was in the United States in the 1870s and 1880s to purchase and to for the tap room to buy or the bar to buy, the consumer to purchase a beer made with about 30% rice. But it progressively got lighter, and I talk about these sort of bursts of growth of the industry that are always associated with a lightening of the lager, if you will. And I'm not saying that the modern American light lager is anywhere like the 1890s, 1900s light lager. Still much more hops, much more malt, particularly hops, not so much on the malt side, but the types of products and adjuncts that could be used. But then, Prohibition just kind of screwed everything up. And World War II happened. And what I talk about in these first two volumes is that the war, the myths are, oh yeah, we couldn't get malt, so the brewers had to use corn and rice, and they cheapened the beer. And then after the war, they figured out they could get their marketing gurus to show bikini-clad gals jumping out of planes and selling beer and not revert back to an all-malt beer. Well, nothing could be further from the truth as to what happened in 1941 to 48. And it was actually from about really 1943, 1948, the lightest lager beer brewed in the United States up to that point in time. It was the lightest beer. And not until the introduction of the modern lights in the 1970s, 1980s, did it get to be that light again. In the interim, it kind of went back to where it was
Well, Greg, you
19.
probably should describe the difference between light, when you say light lager, which is a style of beer, versus low calorie beer, because I think most people who are listening, when they think of light beer, they're thinking of 100 calories, whereas you're talking about Budweiser and Coors Banquet and Stroh's, et cetera, which is a totally different animal.
100%. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, typically these beers would have been 150, 200 calories. When I say adjunct lager beer, the Buds Millers, as they were sold in the 1940s, 1950s, and 60s at all, and only until the 1970s and 80s did the 100 calorie, the modern Bud Light and all that. But yeah, it was a fascinating period because during the war, malt was not the issue of concern to the American brewing industry. It was getting corn and rice because during the war years, they had a lot of applications for military applications. And particularly when I, and the series title, The Inspiring History of American Lager Beer, from 1945 to 1948, the United States was the breadbasket of the world. Supply chains were, shot to hell in much of Europe, much of Asia, and the United States, along with Canada, Britain, Australia, massively supported the aversion of a global famine by corn and rice because they're foods, right? And during that time, we were using cassava, tapioca, potatoes, sorghum grains, you name it, raw barley, anything to get a starch source that could replace the traditional use of corn and rice. And that beer was about 150 calorie beer all the way through the war. Maybe slightly lower because the malt to adjunct ratio did approach the 50-50 by about 1947 before it went back up to where it was pre 1970s beer.
And where, and Dan, you might have some insight on this too. Where does sort of the sort of knee-jerk reaction to adjunct come from? Is this all going back to like Bavarian purity laws and that sort of influencing what people think of as, you know, I guess like official or real or more quality. Like, do you kind of get what I'm saying? Where does the animosity towards an adjunct come from, I guess?
Well, you know, if you look at the English tradition, they started to use sugar as an diluent to the barley malt. And so a lot of the English beer used sugar, but those beers often had caramel syrup or caramel malt in them. So they had some color, and maybe they were dry hops. So they had some intensity to go along with that. The beers in Czech Republic and in Germany are usually all malt, and all malt is filling. It has a full flavor, and therefore you can use more hops to balance that sweetness. And so the beers are bigger, they're more malty, they're more rich, they're more filling. They generally, you could argue, I guess, that the European climate is not the same as American climate. You know, North America, particularly central United States, is humid and hot in the summer. So it's not really conducive to drinking dark beers or full flavored beers. It's more Americans in those areas drink for thirst quenching purposes. But in the post-war and in Pax Americana, American backpackers, a lot of people went to Europe, you know, like the English did during the time of Victoria. They would make their backpacking trips around Europe, and they would maybe go to Prague or go to Munich, and wow, this is a really big beers. And then they came back, and of course, there's always the younger generation always rebels against the older generation. So me being born in 1960, and even people, Greg is a little bit older. You know, our dads drank American style lagers, and so
when straight up Budweiser and Stroh,
exactly. Yeah. And so there's always a need to rebel against that. And the other thing that I think happened is I really think the American large brewers did themselves a disservice, because they, like Greg alluded to, they advertised by, you know, dogs and frogs and women in bikinis and sophomoric nature, and they really did not advertise it as a quality beverage, which it was. I mean, a lot of the beers, most of the breweries in the United States, other than rice or corn, made Reinheitsgebot beer pretty pure, naturally made beers.
Yeah.
But this gave the, unlike American wine business, which, you know, people in straw hats and overall coveralls walking through fields of grapes. And I always am frustrated by that, because I say that wine is much, much more manipulated than beer is. So,
yeah.
So there was, they shot themselves in their foot. They didn't take care of draft lines, and and then one very successful, the most successful large brewery in the world said, every time I lower my beer by one bitterness unit, so I make it less bitter, I get 1 million barrels extra sales. So on one hand, you could say that the customers were asking for lighter and lighter beers, because the last thing I'd like to say is the Coke and Pepsi generation led Americans to have a very sweet, we get used to what we drink. If you grow up drinking Coke and Pepsi, you don't like the bitterness of beer. So in my opinion, American lagers were at their peak in the 80s, because I don't know, Greg might be able to correct me, but you know, it was like 15 bitterness units. Now that's about half that or less. And the beers were very thirst quenching and balanced. But I think that those are all the perfect storm that led to this. And then all of the breweries were closing in America. I mean, I think we were down to, I don't know, 30 or 40 breweries left in the country. So there was an opportunity for, you know, guys to start brewing beer in their basement. And out of that grew this backlash.
Yeah, I, you know, one of the most vivid, I call them American moments. I became a citizen in 92. So prior to that, I remember what I did. It was a close encounter of the third kind in Copenhagen with August Busch III. He was there to talk about contract brewing with Carlsberg to brew Budweiser in Europe. So a chance encounter with three sticks eventually led me, long story, to be that day driving into St. Louis. And I'll never forget hearing the word drinkability. First time I ever heard it was in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. I had done some things that made the business happy with the yeast in terms of purity, stability, and things I can't get into. But the corporate jet going to Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, to give a presentation on my findings. It was an incredible moment. You know, my dad, sixth grade education, my grandfather, second. So for me to be experiencing this was surreal because I'm fundamentally a scientist, right? But yeah, he walked around the room and talked about drinkability. And he was saying, I'll never forget seeing all these slides. Well, this Heilman's going to go out of business this time. Schlitz is going to go. Stroh's going to go. I mean, Henry Weiner's. They were worried about having enough capacity to brew enough light beer with all these other heavier beers, less drinkable beers, going out of business. And then he got to Coors, and I'll never forget, it was like, that's the only beer I fear, gentlemen. And I'd never had a Coors in my life. at that point in time, I was like, what the hell's that? I grew up in Toronto, right? Even then, I don't think you get it east of Mississippi. So that kind of sort of plant the seed. Well, what is it about Anheuser-Busch and Coors and the drinkability that associated with that tuber type yeast, Dan, that became a lifelong passion to understand the relationship between yeast and man as it related to the kind of lager beer each style of yeast brewed?
Wow, that story to me is insane on a couple levels. Like, one being like, did you ever imagine when you were getting your, you know, PhD in applied microbiology that you would end up on a beer jet?
Not in your life.
Like, we're on the private beer jet.
Or in a helicopter from Spirit to St. Louis and landing down in Lake of the Ozarks at a golf course. I called my father right away. Dad!
Oh, jeez.
I had to buy a big Michelob bag. I mean, I was just lucky. I mean, I'm not saying it was a fortuitous. As you get older, you look back on life. It's like, how the hell did I have this journey that I'm sitting here in Colorado?
So much of stuff is luck. It really is. And hard work. Luck and hard work.
You end up on a beer jet because you're lucky and you worked hard.
Yeah.
That's how you end up on a beer jet.
Yeah.
Like, no one's like walking down the street and like, here, hop on. We're going to Coeur d'Alene.
When you have Anheuser-Busch turn around and get about 6 inches from your face and telling you you need to do something at a brewing meeting, you get religion. And you also get resources to do what he wants to be done. And that was, I'll never forget. It seemed like, I vividly remember that first time I was in a meeting with August. I was like, oh my God, this is what it must be like when a head of state or the Pope comes in a room. Because there was an aura, a hush, a silence. Yes. You could tell everybody's butt was puckered. And I'm sitting there with a beard and a skinny leather tie I picked up in Copenhagen, despite having been told August doesn't like beards. And I'm like, well, he's not my father. it was surreal. It was I really look back and very grateful for the family, the ones that were left, you know, the Anheuser-Busch. Peter Stroh was a gentleman. Bill Coors taught me more about applied brewing than any other mentor in my life. And just can't say enough about having been honored to, make their beer more in tune and more process control. Those fish bones, all about process control for the drivers of drinkability. What makes them go up and down? Materials, process, technology, human, and interaction. It sounds simple, but boy. I think, Dan, I think I got almost 6,000 fish bones now.
Really?
I haven't looked at them in 11 years since I retired, being obsessed with the history part. But yeah, Troy says it's absolute proof of obsessive compulsive disorder of his father.
You just got your beautiful mind windows with the dry erase pen all over them in your office.
Well, I can tell you that my copy is... I don't think I have 6,000, but my copy of the book is like 5 feet from my desk, and we'll often pull it up.
Well, Dan, that leads me to a question. It's officially, I believe we can officially call it without jinxing it and having to get out the snowblower again, but it's officially springtime in Wisconsin.
Yeah, looks like it.
Which means the beers are going to be starting to lighten up a little bit, which means that, you know, Totally Naked will be on the horizon, if not already, you know.
Yeah, it should be out by the time this airs.
So when you're developing Totally Naked as an American-style lager beer, And knowing sort of the background and the history of all that stuff and sort of the adjunct wars and the optics of all of that, how difficult was it trying to craft your own sort of take on this style? It's an all malt bill.
It is all malt now, but it didn't used to be.
It didn't used to be? Okay. Yep. And so what was that process like for you sort of making your stamp on this thing?
When we started this brewery, we started out making lager beer, which was, in Wisconsin, Sprecher and Capital were doing it. So, but most craft beer at that time were pale ales, stouts and porters, and maybe a golden ale, is what people made. But as I've said, theme has been of these talks is I'm somewhat contrary and I didn't always want to go the same way as everybody else. And I was with a wholesaler one day and he kind of scoffed, you craft brewers don't know how to make an American style lager. And that really kind of pissed me off because having worked at Anheuser-Busch, I made millions. I was involved in the brewing of millions of barrels of lager beer. And so I said, okay, watch me. And so we called the beer Totally Naked because it's just a very pale, light, easy drinking beer, nothing to hide behind. And you know, I think that the dogma that craft brewers always say is, making such a beer is harder than making a stout. I haven't necessarily found that to be true. Mm-hmm. I think making all beers is difficult. To make a harmonious, like Greg said, drinkable beer is really, really difficult, whether it's a bourbon barrel aged stout or a light lager. The difference is to make a light lager, you need to follow certain idiosyncratic ways of doing it, subtleties. It's about subtlety.
Yeah.
And as Greg alluded to, it's really about the yeast. It's about the fruity flavor in beer and fruitiness is a, as I've said many times, is a appealing flavor to human beings. I mean, we come out of the trees. So, this characteristic is important and subtle. Okay. So when we first start this brewery, I don't know if Greg, you remember Dave Radzinowski. He was brewmaster at the Uber Brewery.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He was also at Siebel teaching.
Yes. And he was somebody that really helped me because he was down the road at the Uber Brewery. And he was a really, really good old school brewmaster, made great beer. And he said to me, Dan, the best beer is made with 10% adjunct, 10%. 90% malt and 10% rice or corn.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, think that there's truth in that. And I said at a keynote address that I gave at the Master Brewers meeting that I think now that craft brewers are starting to try to understand flavor stability and the impact of barley malt on staling of beer, you're going to start to see someone's going to put their toe in the water to start using rice or corn to produce a beer that has better flavor stability.
100%.
10% adjunct, you still have the full impact of the malt, but you increase the drinkability. So we were using corn in Totally Naked, which makes sense for such a beer. But we had a lot of backlash. I got mainly backlash from other brewers, this day I'm still angry about because it's a religious, they're a religious dogmatic lot. And you toe the line or you don't. And then the other thing that happened was things about GMO started to become in the forefront and glyphosates for our customers. And they said, please don't use corn because if you can't get non-GMO corn, which I couldn't. So we switched to making it all malt. And that's where we're at.
And hey, Dan, when did you first brew New Glarus?
We started in 93.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah, we're 31 years now. For some reason, I was going to tack on another 10 for you because I'm not good at math. So it's like 41 years.
Well, it feels like another 10.
41 years now. Yeah. But Greg, I read something, and when I was doing kind of, you know, the quick blush on what your career was all about, and I saw something about an interview of and Dan struck my memory with this, of like the Brewers coming in basically being like, man, we're about to toss you out of the club if you keep this up, you know.
You couldn't even get into the Craft Brewers Association if you used rice or corn. It was verboten.
It was just like, no, you're done.
Oh yeah.
You are done. But was there a story of like in the beginning of, you know, like maybe the 1800s or something, of basically a person getting chased out of a town for using adjuncts?
Can I bring up Ludwig Haker from us? He was born in Württemberg. He came over and spent almost all of 18, and this is the earliest I've been able to document the use of corn to brew lager beer in the United States. He had a patent, Indian corn, a United States patent, 1863. And that, what was going on then? Civil War. Right? this German comes over here to promote his patent. And as was the norm then, they always went back about a year or two later and wrote a big book about their experiences, right? Well, he wrote his book, and it's fascinating in terms of, well, we got run out of Indianapolis when the locals got wind we were using corn to make their lager beer from the German community. But he named breweries. He named where he started to brew, or where German Americans, by that, obviously the local, maybe they were still Germans, not citizens yet, but they were brewing adjunct lager beer. And to your earlier point, Scott, you know, the stigma, if you will, associated with adjuncts, really in the United States was all embellished around the theme of adulteration.
Gotcha.
It was not real beer. Using corn and rice was an abomination. And it really became part of the paradigms, if you will, of every institution of power from the 1870s to 1910s, that we got to stop these Germans from using corn and rice because it's adulterating beer, including the federal government, Supreme Court. And I write about this in terms of every institution of power tried to stop these guys, ironically Germans, right, to brew. And they kept saying, well, we make this beer for you Americans. You know, we make an all malt beer, basically a Dunkel, that was 1840s to 60s. But when they started making this Pilsner, and not just Pilsner per se, as was taken over the world in the 1870s, not taken over, but exploding, we, United States, our cultural norm is we like our beer cold and we like it in a glass. We always have. And those two things, and you look back in history, that's not typically Germanic. You know, there's a guy, a Schaefer in 1901, said Americans drink beer with their eyes, Germans drink beer with their tongue. And what they, yeah, I jumped out of my seat when I read that. And it was like, oh, I get it. And we take it for granted today, but from really about the early 1890s, right up to Prohibition, the only chill-proof beer in the world when it was ice cold was American beer. No other brewery, no other country could match that, nor did they need to for cultural norms. Only in the United States, you serve a lager at 40 degrees, 45, and it's hazy. You put it on ice and it goes, you know, it's been shipped all the way from St. Louis to the deserts of Arizona, put it on ice. The Germans that were always touring in various reasons then were like, how the hell is this still clear? They, you know, they didn't need it for their domestic application. So that was, you know, that was quite inspiring to me in terms of their, you know, the linkage between the consumer pull, because I mentioned earlier, it was more expensive to buy, you know, beer with rice, lager with rice when it was first brought in. It changed later when various corn substitutes became more affordable, but it was all checkered in that, you know, adulteration. And that's what I consider inspiring, is that our beer, it made beer America's national beverage, right? You know, lager beer, this Pilsner adjunct lager beer, we were not a beer culture. You know, there's an article.
Yeah, we were whiskey.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's what a reporter in the Boston Post 1902 said. You know, he saw He said the you could always tell the trail of the Union Army because there were empty bottles of whiskey. He said, I just came back from Havana and the Boxing Revolution in China, right? And he said, U.S. forces are trailed by bottles of empty lager beer. You know, we had become a nation of beer drinkers. And, you know, that to me is inspiring, the technology and the innovations. And it wasn't just using adjuncts to dilute the protein content of six-row barley. There's a whole slew of innovations that was incredibly American, and it's found applications in around the world in ways that we don't really acknowledge, if you will. Again, that stigma is so overpowered, but, you know, Europeans, the Heinekens and Jefferson's, they sent their sons to the United States before Prohibition to learn how to brew lager beer. And that, you know, and it's just pretty wild to see the way history is has gone. And I really, a little plug, Ken Grossman, he wrote a foreword, you know, Ken Grossman, Sierra Nevada, right?
Yeah.
What in the hell is Ken writing a foreword on, you know, adjunct lager beer? When I read his foreword, I was incredibly touched because I wanted in this series to reach not just us in the industry, but Americans have never stepped foot in a brewery, but like beer, like history, like American history. And he nailed it in terms of giving a perspective of a, you know, a pure craft brewer to say, hey, this history is something else. And I'll let readers read it when they read it. But he wrote a foreword to sort of say, hey, craft brewers or traditional critics who would never be caught dead, like you were talking about, Dan, or the crap you took back in the 1990s for daring to use adjuncts. You know, he wrote a foreword there that I hope will resonate in a way that makes people challenge their paradigms. The series is all about that. And then Dick Yingling, he wrote a forward to represent the, you know, the adjunct lager brewers of the United States, sixth generation, right? So those two, I hope, will make people look at our beer quite differently, how it's quite inspiring. And they had to fight to defend it, to be able to preserve the right, to be able to use corn and rice against, like I mentioned, every institution. I talk about this across the five volumes. And it's just a great American story at a time when, you know, we could use a little bit of good history, if you will, in terms of Americana.
I would agree with that. And a couple of things out of your answer that strike me as just very interesting is, well, with the sort of backlash of, and Dan, you're talking about, someone's going to, you know, you're going to find very quickly, craft brewers are going to decide that, you know, they can make an adjunct, whatever now, right? That's just, sure. It's going to happen. They're going to do it. But when they do it, it's going to be ironically hip.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, there's going to be a wink and a nod. It's going to be like, the first one is definitely going to be like, hey guys, I know I'm doing something here, kind of a deal, you know?
Sure.
Because everything sort of comes full circle with that. And what you were saying sort of struck in my head of like, you know, for someone like Ken Grossman or someone like Dan to be defending the use of adjuncts in beer, these are people who no one can really question their credentials in the craft beer world, right? Like they you just really can't. But I think why you guys would do that is because, Dan, you strike me as someone who's a, you know, you're a brewer. You're not here you're here to do as much as you can with beer.
Yeah.
You're not here to put limits on that.
It's a style. It's a style that's a legitimate style, just like a IPA or a Weiss beer. And this is how it's brewed.
Yeah. So why wouldn't you brew it the way it's supposed to be brewed?
Sure.
Right. And there's nothing inherently wrong with it.
I love a nice T-bone steak that's properly cooked just as much as I do a hot dog or a pizza. They all have their place. And if you're a true foodie, you're not going to turn your nose up to any of those. They're all legitimate.
Yeah, well, it's like the person who gets mad at McDonald's leaves like the 1-star review, like the burger was whatever. It's like, well, yeah, where are you?
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Like, use your contextual brain to put a proper assessment on what you are you're doing, exactly, or consuming, I guess.
Exactly. But Greg, why don't you tell us the name of this series and when it's coming out and how people can buy it, because
this is very fascinating.
We're alluding to this five parts book series, and kind of tell us the name and when it's coming out, et cetera.
Yeah, it was 16 years in the making, as terms of the obsessive compulsive that gave the fish bones. The 16 years of research in the history of the industry that I spent my career in, and that the history that just stunned me. You know, I had no idea of the history of the use of adjuncts in brewing American lager beer at all, and the controversial nature of it. So the series is called The Inspiring History and Legacies of American Lager Beer. Kind of a odd topic, right? You wouldn't associate that with American lager beer, but it's a five-volume series. It's being published through with the MBAA, and I can't say enough about John Palmer, the editor, the people at Scientific Societies in St. Paul, Sue Freese, Dawn West. I mean, I'm really blessed because I had no idea how you publish a book, right? A PhD thesis is one thing, but to take that and be able to tell stories. John Palmer was an incredible mentor. So the first two volumes are coming out this year, and it covers the period 1941 to 1948. So that period was taken because of the many myths associated. When did American brewers start to use corn and rice and all that? So we delve into, well, what does the archives say? What does the historical? And I really, really go to a lot of trouble to just let the people of the era speak for themselves verbatim. The amount of research that takes to be able to capture that so that their voice is heard. I'm just couching the circumstances, like World War II, that's got nothing to do with lager beer, but this is the circumstances. So the first volume is coming out within a month. I don't have the specific date, but that is the examination of the beers of myths and legacies denied. So I talk about, we've got a lot of legacies and the people we have totally figured out. And I'm not talking about the Bushes, the Coors Millers. I'm talking about brewing scientists and brewers that went to bat to protect the right of the American brewer to brew the beer of our choice and the consumer to choose the beer of their choice, which today is the most vibrant beer in the world, country in the world, right? There's no better time to be alive than right now. It'd be like beer in the United States. But all that was at risk. The Reinheitsgebot, the German one came up, not until my grandfather was alive, put it that way, when the rest of the German Empire joined Bavaria. And my father was alive when from 1921 to 24, they were making adjunct lager beer in Germany to the same percent ratios we were prior to Prohibition. I mean, these are parts of history that are bizarre and fascinating. But anyhow, so the first volume is that. The second volume is coming out, I think, July. It should be out before the WBC, Dan, in Minneapolis. And it's about the beer of war and global famine relief. So the beer, it looks at, we go year by year through, well, what happened in the industry? The first one's kind of setting up to the reader, we don't know our own history. I'm not surprised by that because, history is kind of boring to many people. But if it's beer, hopefully it's a little more interesting.
that is definitely an in for me to start learning history. Like you tie it to beer.
Well, you got
to
draw it in. Like I said, I've had some sort of little digs, you really haven't had this peer reviewed by historians, academic. And I'm like, I know. That's by design. I'm retired. I just want to have a passion in retirement that fills these hopefully decades. And, to be able to talk about something where I look to the American public to give peer review, just as for 150 years, they've given beer review by their purchasing decisions of a style of beer that I joined in later. So that's this year, the first two. Then each of the following 3 years, each fall, will be volume three, which is the title. It goes from 1850s to 1924, born in Germany. I realized very early on, you can't talk about our history of adjunct lager beer without talking about Germany's. They're just so intertwined.
It's just like NASA. It's the same thing. Our rocket program.
Oh, exactly. It just blew me away. You know,
maybe the not set of Project Paperclip is the Project Beerstein. We also took the Brewers.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I've had a couple of Germans of notoriety, you know, review what I've been researching and finding, and saying to me, "This is very dangerous."
Yeah.
That makes sense because you're in the first volume, you were talking about the myth, sort of the myth making. And if you would have asked me when was all of Germany doing the Rhein-Heiß-Gebot, I'd be like, I don't know. That's wizard stuff. Probably since, you know, King Arthur was around. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just, it has that sort of feeling to most people who don't study the history of it. So hearing like, oh yeah, my dad was alive when the whole country stopped using adjuncts. Like, well, that sort of takes the mythos out of the dragon.
It blew me away. I mean, I had, you know, I've always loved as a, you know, I still to this day, I don't when I read something, I'm usually reading about World War II history, you know, as a kid of that generation.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, Canadian version, right? But, you know, when I start digging into this, you know, it just blew me away. For example, the Reichstag, Berlin, opened 1873, right? The very opening paragraph in the address to the now United Empire, they beat the French. Oops, sorry. In Franco-Prussian, Americans weren't ready yet to come over and save their butt.
We won't go there.
But, you know, the opening paragraph, Bismarck, the first chancellor of the German Empire, in his opening paragraph talks about the need to tax brewing adjuncts for the revenue generating streams of this new empire that was going to compete in a global basis. First paragraph. I'm reading this book like, what? And he was talking about, you know, up until that point in time, you think about it, every Hanseatic city, the only thing they taxed in each of the duchies and the states and whatever kingdoms was malt. That's how they generate revenue. But by this point in time, 1873, they had 20 years in Germany of using rice and using other adjuncts. And the Reichstag, well, only started in 73, but the treasury wasn't deriving income from brewers who were using adjuncts. So he put that in place. And they're very good at keeping statistics. And every year from that right up until when my grandfather was born, June 3rd, 1906, he was born before that, those statistics were collected by individual region within the empire. True Bavaria? No disagreement, 1516. But there was the empire's Rhein-Heiß-Gebot, the rest of Germany, with the exception of a few border state regions to Bavaria, didn't join the Rhein-Heiß-Gebot until June 3rd, 1906. And I was blown away by that.
That's crazy.
And the reason was it had nothing to do with quality. It had, if you think about the history, the German Empire needed to build the Navy. And that it was embellished under the German tax code changes that resulted in a massive increase in taxes on beer and likewise standardized to the Bavarian, not beer, but malt, standardized it to the Bavarian model. And what did the German consumers do? The Bierkrieg, beer wars from 1906, 1907, it was all passed on to the consumer. Germans. Production declined, and it was during that window that the United States became the leading producer of the beer in the world until China did fairly recently. But that was all to build the Navy, and that I sort of outlined that. And then after the war, 1921, with the Weimar Republic, remember you, as kids seeing wheelbarrows of marks to buy a loaf of
great bread, inflation.
And, you know, well, you can imagine making beer at that point in time was very difficult. So from the Weimar Republic, 1921 to 1924, they gave approval, basically restored what they had been allowed to do from 1872 to 1906. So we had prohibition, and the Germans were brewing adjunct lager beer at about, you know, 30% adjunct for domestic consumption in Germany. And that's when my father was alive. So that, you know, it's important for me, for the American reader to go, well, you think, we don't know our history. You got to know theirs before you can fully appreciate ours. And then the last two volumes, pardon me if I'm rambling here, but the last two volumes are our story. you know, the rise in perfection of America's beer I talk about in volume four, what it was way beyond just, you know, the use of adjuncts that made it the technological marvel of the world as the only chill-proof lager beer for decades, and how the world was coming to investigate us. And then the last, and that's really a examination, it's called the defense of our beer. You know, and you know, you get Library of Congress, you can get the congressional hearings in 1890, Turner Adulteration Bill, which spelled out prison sentences, confiscation of property, et cetera, et cetera, if it had passed for brewers that use corn and rice.
Well, geez, Dan, you're lucky they just gave you a talking to.
Yeah, right.
That's just the federal government. You know, then you had the Supreme Court got involved. State of Missouri banned Pabst from even passing beer through the state if it had corn. They couldn't prove it had corn, but, you know, that you have to be able to prove what was in it. And he sued the state of Missouri for preventing him from transporting Pabst Blue Ribbon because it had corn. And he lost. Supreme Court said, yeah, Missouri could do that, you know, because it's food adulteration and it's impure beer. It was just crazy. And I go through all the media, the medical, the state levels, every institution of power tried to stop it.
Well, it's funny now, Greg, because you must snicker when you see, you know, all of the hullabaloo about all of these different touchstones of you know, red versus blue states and all the things people are arguing about in Supreme Court cases. It's nothing new. We've been doing this forever as a country. God, we've been arguing about things.
Well, yeah, as it turns out, you can't tell the story of America without the story of American craft lager. And we have a long history of getting mad at the people who sell us the things we want.
Yeah,
exactly. We have never been stasis. You know, there was a line I quote in the opening volume in the western frontier town of Milwaukee in the 1840s. You know, and West then was still pretty much as it was prior to our arrival. But he wrote back to Frederick Pabst, and he said, "In America is a country that is always in the process of becoming."
Yes.
Yep.
That's true.
And I read that.
That's true.
Here's the guy. I don't know if he had a college education, but he wrote those words. And I went, you know, as a naturalized citizen, I'm like, oh my God, that just hit me like, boom.
Yeah. He's right. But it's, you know, it's true.
We're always in the process of becoming, whether it's a good becoming, bad, I don't care. It's our nature, you know,
Abraham Lincoln say? I have great trust in the people to make the right decision as long as they're given enough information and beer.
Yeah. Well, guys, I think we're running up against our limit. But Greg, thank you very much for your time. And again, the series of books, the first one will be published this month, you said?
They'll come out through the MBA. I don't have the exact
link. Master Brewers Association of America.
That's the Inspiring and Surprising History and Legacies of American Lager Beer.
Not surprising. It did say surprising in the past, but the Inspiring History and Legacies of American Lager Beer. And I'm not making a penny. I'm donating 100% of author royalties, some called taps.org, which provides emotional and tactile support for families who've lost military loved ones, and with National Guards being disproportionate in their losses compared to history. A lot of moms and dads have not come home. And I'm going to donate 100% of everything. I'm not doing this for self-promotion. This is Greg Casey's way of giving back to a country that is
good man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
You know,
that is very awesome. I would say beer people are the best people, you know.
Yeah,
they just are. You guys are just out there trying to make a good product that makes people feel good. And half the time
in the end, brewing beer is all about trying to give people just a moment of happiness. To have a nice beer is a gift that you can give to people, that they can have a moment of peace and little vacation to have a nice glass of beer. Just like Greg said, to stare at a beautiful glass of beer and drink it. It's a simple, relatively inexpensive pleasure.
Well said, Dan.
Well, thank you for your time, Greg. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Greg. I appreciate it too.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Gesundheit, as they said back then.